This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 166. Let's go crazy, honey child. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Daniel Prue. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including 18 years of Star Trek First Contact, the final push for Mark Cushman's These Are the Voyages, Volume 3, and we debate which crew faced the most adversity. Then in the feature, we're joined by Suzanne Abbott and Andy Vanderkolk to discuss the TNG episode, The Naked Nell. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Daniel. It's great to have you here on the Ready Room with me, especially because this is a TNG week here. How's everything going?
Good, Chris. Thanks for having me. It's a little hot in here. Do you mind if I, you know, take off my uniform? Is that okay? Or
yeah, you're sweating, Daniel. Is everything okay?
Yeah, listen, Chris. I love Star Trek and I love Trek FM. I'm just having a great time right now. I just want to take off my uniform. Is that okay? Is that okay?
Sure, go right ahead. I mean, you know, the episode we're going to talk about today, people in there showed no inhibitions.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they showered with their clothes on. I want to live with my clothes off. So I think that's what I'm going to do for this episode.
Now I'm thinking, did you ever watch Wings? Do you know the sitcom Wings?
Absolutely, yeah.
There's an episode where they go to this house and they're all naked all the time. Oh, man, that was a funny episode. All right, well, we're not here to talk about Wings anyway. We're here to talk about Star Trek, and it is TNG week, and so it's very fitting that we're going to talk about First Contact as our first news item here. Last week, we talked about 20 years of Generations, which was really hard for me to believe, but this past week, also on November 22nd, marked 18 years since First Contact premiered in the theater, and I'd like to hear about your memories of seeing First Contact for the first time. Now, did you see it in the theater when it premiered?
That is a good question. I actually don't remember if I saw this in the theaters. I feel like I did, but that could, you know, sometimes your memory plays tricks with you and you can manufacture
Well, you were like, what, two, three?
1996, Chris, I was 10 years old. Thank you very much. Almost, I was 10 and a half, okay? I was almost 11. So.
Okay, all right. That's when you were counting halves, right?
I do remember, in fact, some of the only Star Trek toys I ever had where I had a Picard and a Riker Star Trek First Contact, they must have been 6 to 8 inch figurines, and they were fantastic. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, they did the bigger figures with the First Contact merchandise.
Yeah. And I mean, come on now, like First Contact. If we're going to talk Star Trek movies, like you, I listened to the Ready Room last week, and you guys talked about Generations, and Generations is an important film, unfairly maligned sometimes. But if we're going to talk Star Trek movies, First Contact changed everything. It even changed Star Trek on TV. Like, after this, Deep Space Nine gets the uniforms, and it's such a good movie. Oh my goodness, there are some problems. You know, no movie's perfect, and it has some problems. But I couldn't love this movie more. We get the E, we get the Enterprise E. Oh my goodness, come on now! And I just wish we had more.
Well, speaking of the E, so the reveal of the E at the beginning of the movie is beautiful. But the E is one of the things that I was trying so hard to avoid finding out about this film before it opened. I didn't want to know what the new Enterprise was going to look like until I could see it on the screen. And I really didn't want to know anything about the film at all. And, you know, these days I don't have that approach because, of course, doing Trek FM, I need to find out about Star Trek movies as they're being made so we can talk about them. But back then, I was one of those, I'm in blackout mode. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know anything about it. I want to go in the theater and I want to be amazed at all the new things that I see. And what I remember is that they were marketing the hell out of this movie. And now they didn't have the cool Worf cup tops, I guess, like they did for Generations, which someone posted in the Babel conference that apparently they did in Canada for Generations. But what I do remember is that the gas station that I would always go to in Alabama had some sort of cross promotion, and the big cardboard, print above the gas pump where they would put ads was some sort of tie-in with Star Trek First Contact, and the E was right there above every gas pump. And so I could not avoid it. And I was so frustrated, but I managed to avoid most everything about the film. And I remember that my best friend at the time, we worked together at this publishing company, and he was a huge, huge Trekkie as well. And this is probably the only film that I was able to go to with a friend who was a big Trekkie. Because after this film, I moved to Japan. And I went to see Generations, as I talked about last week, but that was just with some friends from university who weren't necessarily Trekkies.
Yeah, and you know what? Now that we're talking about this, Chris, you're a Niner, I'm a TNG-er. I have a question for you about this. Look, in TNG and the Season 6 Blu-rays, we gave you Birthright. So you got to see the station, mm-hmm. you got to see the promenade in Blu-ray. In First Contact, you got to see the Defiant on Blu-ray. Like, we're giving you everything you need. Are you more desperate for more Deep Space Nine on Blu-ray? We're trying to help you out here. Of course I'm kidding. Because I want just as much as anyone else to see Deep Space Nine on Blu-ray. First Contact, man, a lot of people compare it to Star Trek II, I think. Like, it's the Star Trek II. It's Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, well, it's the strongest movie for most people of the TNG films. Yeah. Whereas the Wrath of Khan is of the original.
And, it is so good. And like you mentioned, the E, we get to see it. And of course, you couldn't avoid it. And by the way, which is okay because it has the best nacelles of any ship ever. Of all the ships, best nacelles.
Oh, yeah. It's been a while since we've had a big nacelle chat, Daniel.
Yeah, when you're ready, Chris, to do the ready room nacelle show off, I have pages and pages prepared to go.
The nacelle-aganza. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And, I can't specifically remember my first time seeing this movie, but I can tell you every time I watch it, I just have a good time. It's just fun. It's just so much fun. It is TNG encapsulated into a movie, way more than Generations was. It's just like, oh, it's the Borg, of course, naturally. And there's time travel. Well, that's Star Trek. And, we see all of these character interactions that are really good. And, we get a new ship. And it's, I don't know. Everybody loves, I don't know. I'm just treading water at this point. Everybody loves First Contact. I'm so happy. 18 years. That's crazy. It's a long time.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those films where it so completely paid off for fans of the series, but yet it was perfectly accessible to the general public. You could enjoy this movie if you knew nothing at all about Star Trek. But if you were a fan of The Next Generation on television, this movie gave you so much. One thing that I remember, my best friend who I mentioned earlier, he was not trying to avoid spoilers. He was trying to find out everything about the movie he could beforehand to get excited about it. And he was finding out things like there's this holodeck sequence and it's the big goodbye. And he told me, like, this is a huge film. There's so much stuff in this film. And I've always loved the fact that they did that callback to the big goodbye. I mean, when Picard walks up to that panel and he starts tapping it out and it says the big goodbye, I thought it's just so brilliant that they're calling back to this first season episode. And here it is. And it just makes you feel like all those years of watching TNG are paying off and all these tiny things sprinkled all over the place in this film.
And, like TNG is my favorite. It's my show. It's my favorite show. Mm-hmm. But as much as The Big Goodbye sticks out to me, one of my favorite sequences in the entire thing that I love about the shared universe that Star Trek is the EMH in this movie. Like it's, mm-hmm. I think it's one of the strongest scenes. You know, Beverly calls him up and he's like, oh, you know, it's Robert Picardo being Robert Picardo. So it's, you know, it's golden. And of course we even get Neelix, right? Neelix on TNG. And I don't know. I just, you know, of course it's wonderful. It's a film that it's wonderful that it calls back to The Big Goodbye. I agree completely, but it's also wonderful that it recognizes Star Trek for what it was at the time. Like I said, we see the Defiant. Tough little ship, which is actually a callback mm-hmm. to the episode Defiant from Deep Space Nine. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it is one of the few times that we kind of recognize the whole universe, the whole Star Trek universe, that it is a complete and it's a real place that one could live and exist in. And then there are consequences that happen and all of these things. And then, of course, way later on, retconned technically, I guess, but it's nice that it's picked up in Enterprise as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, this is a case where the EMH, it makes perfect sense. You know, it is a cameo, it is a tie-in to Voyager, but it also makes sense that the Enterprise E would have an EMH, and we already know that they're all going to look like Zimmerman, so that works. There is a book series, I believe there are six of them, called Slings and Arrows. They're really short e-novellas that fill in the gap between Generations and First Contact. And in the one called That Sleep of Death, which we've done on Literary Treks, we actually find out why Beverly hates the EMH so much in that scene in First Contact.
I swear to myself, I'd never use one of these. Like I just assume it's because she's like going to be out of a job kind of a thing, but that would be interesting to read, I think.
Yeah, it kind of relates to that a little bit, at least in terms of funding for projects. So that's an interesting one. But there's just so much in this film that I love the fact that they used Ooby Dooby by Roy Orbison in here. And I also love the Steppenwolf as the Phoenix is launching. And the first time you see it, it's so awesome. Cochran's, I can't go without this. And they find it and he pops it in. And you're wondering, like, what is it? Is it some kind of important flight data? What is it? No, it's Magic Carpet Ride by Steppenwolf.
It's such an amazing sequence. But what I love about it is that they took this character, this kind of obscure character from the one episode of TOS. And mm-hmm. I mean, of course, in TOS, he's the pioneer of
Warp. Well, he's not obscure in terms of Star Trek history, but we only saw him in Metamorphosis, right?
So. And it's interesting that we see his future in even his Enterprise future, right? We never actually explore that, like what gets him to that place, but a big theme of the episode is, you know, this kind of revisionist history kind of thing is like, we make heroes out of regular people. And he mm-hmm. was just a guy and he wanted, just like every free man, he wants to pee in the woods. Just let him go. You know what I'm saying?
You know, they originally offered that role to Tom Hanks, but he was busy getting ready to direct and co-star in That Thing You Do at the time. So he didn't take on the role, although Tom Hanks is a Star Trek fan. And I guess maybe he would have done it otherwise if he had been free. Can you imagine Tom Hanks in the role of Zefram Cochrane?
Tom Hanks would have been interesting, I think. But James Cromwell as Zefram Cochrane, you know, I don't know. It's hard to see someone else in that role. Would Tom Hanks have fit alongside? This would have been the same year that Toy Story came out, right? 1996? Is that 1998? Mm. I can't remember. It would have been really interesting to see Tom Hanks as Zefram Cochrane. I don't know. How do you feel about that? No, something sits weird with me about that. I don't think I'd be okay with that.
I don't know. I mean, I think that he could have played the role and maybe it would have been wonderful, but it would be very different than what we got. So it's kind of hard to imagine right now what it would have been like. You know, it's kind of like trying to imagine what if Cybok had been played by Sean Connery, right? Well, it would have been a completely different character. I don't know that what you said a moment ago about revisionist history and showing that we make heroes out of ordinary people. I think that the way that James Cromwell played Zefram Cochrane as this drunk, you know, this brilliant engineer, a brilliant scientist, who was also a drunk and didn't really want the fame or the notoriety, is really important to the way that this film plays out. And so I think the whole tone of the film could be very different if you didn't have that. And I mean, Tom Hanks, of course, he could play that kind of humorous bit as well, but I'm just trying to picture him doing it. And I think that it would have been significantly different. And I think that the casting, you know, often they offer these roles to big names and people can't do it. And then they cast someone else. And I think that's just the way that things tend to work themselves out, that often you do get the right person. That way, the right person for role isn't necessarily the biggest name.
Now, Chris, let me ask you this question, because I feel like this is relevant. If Tom Hanks were to play someone named like Zephrama Cochran, you know, as a continuation of his bosom buddies kind of role, would that make you a little bit more comfortable?
I could see it where you've got that, and then Lily is actually a guy who just goes around in drag all the time in First Contact, and they were bosom buddies, and they were responsible for the invention of warp drive that propelled mankind into the stars. So, you know, that would be a great tie-in.
Well, we need to see it happen. Come on now. Bosom buddies, First Contact.
Exactly. I did have a question for you here, and you mentioned, well, we talked earlier a little bit about how this pays off for the fan, but is accessible to the general audience. And back when this movie came out, Adam Smith of Empire Magazine said that some characters, particularly Troy and Crusher, were lost or ignored, and the rapid pacing of the film left no time for those unfamiliar with the series to know or care about the characters. And I don't know if that's a fair criticism, really. In a way, I see it as a strength, which is that to enjoy it as an action film, you don't really need to care that much about the characters. But if you are familiar with the series, you actually see a lot of new things in the characters here, and I think it pays off very strongly for you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Troy specifically, her standout scene is it's one of the best scenes in the entire movie. Like, it's,
yeah.
And it's not like you need to know who Troy is to respect or understand that scene. She needs to figure out what's going on. She does it by getting drunk, and it's fun and it's silly and it's a good time. Like, that's such a weird thing to point out. And while Crusher is kind of lost in the shuffle a bit, I agree with you. You don't, again, it's not a character that you need to understand her motivations to see what she's doing or why she's doing it. It's everything serves the story in that movie. Everything flows to push the story forward. So,
you know, I suppose that maybe the bit with Data and the temptation of becoming human would be a little bit hard to wrap your mind around if you don't know anything about Data. But maybe not completely. You know, he's an android. You know he's not human. If you're watching the film, it's established as the film goes on. So, but this criticism about the pacing was pointed out by a number of reviewers at the time. And, you know, we see First Contact as fans. We see First Contact as being one of the great Star Trek films, and we acknowledge the fact that it is an action movie. You know, it is sort of a zombie space movie. It's very quickly paced for much of the film, and we hold it up as being one of the prime examples of great Star Trek on the big screen. At the same time, as fans, we heavily criticize the JJ movies for being fast-paced action movies. So, do you see a difference there? I mean, is it just, and we're dealing with characters, Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and characters that we know, only they're not directly tied to their past. Is that the difference?
Not to me. I don't criticize 2009. In fact, 2009 is, oh, I don't want to get in trouble. 2009 is one of my favorite Star Trek movies. I think it's amazing. I think it's fantastic. A lot of people criticize it for a lot of things, and that's okay. I think a lot of people forget maybe how much of an action movie Wrath of Khan is? Like, that's why, because people say Wrath of Khan, mm-hmm. Undiscovered Country. And those are two very different movies, of course. But Wrath of Khan, very, very heavily kind of action-based kind of movie, kind of, especially towards the end, of course. There's a lot of, Wrath of Khan is amazing. There's lots of themes and important things that you can get out of it. But it's a revenge story, essentially, which is what a lot of movies are. And 2009 kind of is. And First Contact also kind of is. And, you know, it depends. I don't care. As long as Star Trek is trying to tell a good story, I can get behind it. And depending on how the execution is, that's fine. First Contact, execution's fantastic. Wrath of Khan, fantastic. I don't know. I am an apologist. I'm a JJ apologist as far as the first movie goes. Getting into it further, there is a whole separate subject. The way a lot of people see First Contact as the next generation's Wrath of Khan, I can kind of see that. It's got a lot of similar themes running throughout, and it's the same kind of thing of an old enemy coming back, and how do you deal with that, and things are changing, and you're getting older, and there's a lot of similar themes that run throughout. I actually agree with that to a large extent.
Interesting. Well, it's hard to believe it's been 18 years. I remember so well going to see this in the theater. But I'd love to know your memories. I'd love to hear about your memories from that time. So head over to the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and that'll take you right over there. Or click discussion on the menu bar on our website. That's a closed group, so you need to click join and I'll let you in. But it's just a group for our listeners. And we have hundreds of people over there right now. And I'm pretty sure there's already a thread. I know there's already a thread about First Contact. And it's 18th anniversary, people sharing their thoughts. But let us know what you think about it. We'd really love to hear about you and your experiences with First Contact. And of course, if you agree or disagree with some of the things that Daniel and I have said here today talking about this. All right, so Daniel, one more thing to talk about here. StarTrek.com polls, we love to talk about these on the Ready Room. The latest one is, the crew that faced the most adversity was... So tell us what the results were.
With a whopping, like, this is, I actually participate in these polls a lot, Chris. I don't know if you do or not. Actually go and actually click what you vote for.
Sometimes. Yeah.
But I do quite a bit. And this is probably one of the biggest gaps I've ever seen. 55% of the vote is Voyager. And then, of course, Enterprise is right behind that, with 14. The original series just ekes by with 11, and TNG and Deep Space Nine are at 10%. And this is a really interesting poll. Naturally, I was going to make a joke. I was going to say TNG should be first because I'm a TNG guy, of course. But no, this is the least likely poll that TNG would ever come up as number one as. The big joke. But I don't know. I like TNG being technically last and Voyager being first, but I have a feeling maybe you feel differently.
Well, this result for me, because of the overwhelming number of votes for Voyager, it feels like my classic take on StarTrek.com polls, which is that Voyager will always win. Now, that hasn't actually proven to be true recently, but there was a long period of time where every poll on StarTrek.com would be won by the Voyager choice, to the point where I felt like someone would find a way to write in a Voyager choice if one wasn't given so that Voyager could win the poll. And I feel part of that has to do with age groups, that, you know, your favorite Star Trek is often the one that you grew up with. And we're at a point right now where there are so many people who, they were teenagers, maybe early university age, when Voyager was on the air. And so for them, that's what got them into Star Trek. And so that's their favorite. And that's understandable. And so they naturally vote for Voyager. The poll is odd to me. I'm glad to see that Enterprise came in second, but it's 14% against 55%. Enterprise, the entire third season of that series, is this one tiny ship, which if you put it next to Voyager, it's a tiny little ship with very poor weapons, you know, very poor defenses. And they were charged with protecting the entire future of humanity. The Earth would have been destroyed. And the things that they go through during that third season in order to save mankind is in its constant for them. It's just constant. And they all pay a heavy price, I think psychologically, for what they went through as well, in a way that I don't see on Voyager. I mean, Voyager, yes, they were lost on the other side of the galaxy, and that is an adverse situation for a crew. There's no doubt about it. And they faced some very difficult situations, like Year of Hell. You know, I kind of find it hard to feel like the Kazon were any huge threat to them, really. So you've got situations like Year of Hell. But they also had time to do things like stop off for some pecan pie. You know, they had time to play on the holodeck all the time. You know, it's not to say that they didn't face adversity, but 55% against all the other series is a little surprising to me. And then Deep Space Nine, this crew was at the front line of a war that killed billions of Federation citizens and that threatened for the entire Alpha and Beta Quadrant to be taken over by this ruthless force in the Dominion. And they, you know, they lost crewmates. Nog lost his leg. Sisko lost his corporeal life. There were so many things that crew went through. To have them at 10% below the original series, where, you know, Kirk got to fight Lady Gaga, you know, things like that. A little bit surprising to me. The Next Generation at 10% at the bottom, I think is probably right, because of all the Trek crews, the Enterprise D, they had a pretty cushy life, really, week to week.
I'm not going to argue any level of that. Like, I'm not going to argue the fact that we should be last in this poll. TNG should be last in this poll without a doubt. Not that necessarily the Enterprise D had a great time all the time, but most of the time it was, do you want to go to this planet? We'll bring you to this planet. It's totally fine. But it's interesting. I didn't actually participate in this poll, but I would have given it to Voyager. Honestly, that would have, Voyager, not my favorite show, but if I think about it and I think, what is the last ship I want to be on? Or the last crew I want to be a part of, because it seems like the toughest or the most undesirable, I'm going to give it to Voyager. I don't want to be in the Delta Quadrant 60,000 light years away from the rest of everything that I've ever known in my entire life.
Is it just because you're afraid that you'll get the room next to Harry?
Yeah, I might. I don't want to hear his clarinet playing. I agree with you. Enterprise, Deep Space Nine would be right behind that. To me, I don't know if you think that Voyager should be top, but Enterprise and Deep Space Nine would be kind of Deep Space Nine. Yes, later on in the beginning, you would think that you would accept that position because it's kind of a backwater place.
Well, sure, but we have to take this as over the course of their entire run.
Right.
Which crew faced the most adversity?
And I think that Deep Space Nine crew only had it tough towards the end, 5, 6, and 7 seasons, maybe. What, like when the
The Dominion comes in season 2, so
right, but they don't actually attack, right? Like, they don't, I mean, of course, and then of course we have the Klingons in season 4 with that whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, but maybe we disagree on this.
Well, don't forget about Kai Winn. I mean, you know, Janeway never had anyone like that to deal with.
You know what, I tell you what, I will deal with Kai Winn any day over Vedic Barayal, because Vedic Barayal will put me to sleep every time he's anywhere near me. So
yeah,
I don't know. Like, Chris, if you voted, what would your number 1, 2, and 3 be?
I would probably vote DS9 first, which of course everyone listening is going, of course you would, because you're a niner. But I think DS9 and Enterprise and then Voyager. Now, I do think Deep Space Nine, Enterprise, and Voyager all have a case, whereas the original series and the Next Generation, I think, don't have a case that can compete with those three. But for me, the thing about Voyager is that Voyager always had the option of settling down on some planet somewhere. They could have done that. You know, and there was no life or death for anyone beyond the confines of that ship that they were dealing with.
See, it's an interesting conversation because I think that Voyager and Enterprise always have the same option. Well, if you say that Voyager has the option to settle down, Enterprise has the option to turn around. Except in season three, of course.
But not in season three.
Except season three. Yeah. But it's the same kind of thing where it's like you do have an option to get out of the situation that you're in. Deep Space Nine didn't have that because they're right. Hey, we're right here in front of the wormhole. And TOS and Enterprise are kind of in the same situation. Whereas we're going out there, we don't have to go out there. We could stay put and be comfortable, but we want to go out there. So I don't know. Again, I would give Voyager number one because first of all, 99% of the people on that ship didn't vote to say, let's get stuck behind here and travel for the next, you know, 50 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas even on Deep Space Nine, you can get stationed or moved or whatever. And on Enterprise, at least the people on that ship are choosing to go forward. I don't know. I agree with you. To me, it's Voyager, Enterprise, and Deep Space Nine. But I have to give it to Voyager because the first thing that comes into my head, and I'm sure 55% of the people agree with me, is Year of Hell. And even though it's a big reset button episode, that is what could happen. That could happen any time on that ship. And you don't want to be there when that happens.
Yeah. No, I see that as well. So, yeah, it's hard to choose, but those three are the three that have the case for me. And then which order you put them in, I think probably primarily has to do, except in your case, Daniel, because you're a TNG guy, and which series is your favorite, perhaps. So anyway, I'd like to know what everyone else thinks about this. So let us know this in the Babel Conference as well. And of course, if you're not on Facebook, you can send us messages by going to trek.fm/contact, using the form there, choosing to send to a show, and choosing the Ready Room. And that'll come to me by email. And we're also on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Well, one more quick thing that we have to talk about here, Daniel. I was able to catch up with Mark Cushman to talk about his book, These Are the Voyages, Volume 3, which will conclude his in-depth look at the original series. And there's a Kickstarter for that to help it get published this year. So we're going to bring Mark in and talk about that real quick. Mark, thanks for dropping by today to talk a little bit here about These Are the Voyages, Volume 3. I'm really excited that the third volume in this series is coming out. We've had you here on the network many times in the past to talk about Volumes 1 and 2, but Volume 3, you're doing something a little bit different here with this Kickstarter campaign.
Right. The release of the book had been pushed back until spring of next year, and I'm so anxious to get it out there that we try to find a way to make that happen. And a couple of people came forward and said they would manage a Kickstarter campaign. And we've been doing that so that we can get it out before Christmas time. And it's looking like we'll be able to get these things in the mail around the 14th of December. And hopefully people in the United States can get it right before Christmas.
That's awesome. Are there any particular things about the potential delay into the spring that you can tell us about? Were there any unexpected bumps, or is it just the nature of publishing and how long it takes to actually put out a book like this?
It's the nature of publishing. I'll tell you, book three is the biggest of the three. I mean, this thing is 750 pages long, and it's 400 pictures, which is a lot more than we had in the other two volumes.
Wow.
And so it just took more time to get it all worked out and formatted and get it ready for print, but also a greater expense in getting these hardbacks made. Prices of everything are going up. And so financially, it was just better to wait until early next year to put it out. But I knew there were a lot of fans. I get letters all the time from people saying, we got to have it. You know, we've read the first two and we're hooked and we're waiting for book three. So we got into a discussion and said, well, let's leave it up to the people who have been reading the books. If they want it now rather than waiting 3 months, we'll give them a way to make that happen. And that's the Kickstarter campaign. And you can find it on Kickstarter by just going to These Are the Voyages. And it has a lot of different levels to where for $40 you can get a copy of the book, which is about what it would cost anyway with tax and postage and everything.
Right. Yeah.
If you bought it later, but you can get a different level that would give you film trims, scripts, because I have all the scripts that Susan Sackett had provided me with. She was Gene Roddenberry's assistant way back in the 80s. And John D.F. Black has kindly offered to autograph his script, The Naked Time, for anybody who wants to get that particular script. So they can pick the script they want, or they can get John's script, they can get film trims, they can get all kinds of little goodies along with the book if they want to go with a higher pledge.
Excellent. Yeah, I think, like you said, the contribution level, it's kind of what you would pay for the book in the first place, right? And plus you've got digital copies on there as well.
Right, because when the book is available, it's going to be $29.95 plus $6 mm-hmm. shipping just for the U.S. plus tax. So you're looking at about $40 anyway. You make a $40 pledge, and that'll include the shipping, that'll include everything. The tax will be covered. So it's pretty much the same price, and you'll be able to get it sooner. And because of the people who have made these contributions, we'll be able to make the book available to other people sooner as well. But the Kickstarter donators will get it first. Those will be the first books to go out. They'll all be autographed, and they will go out the minute we receive them from the printers. Print run is scheduled for the 1st and 2nd of December.
Awesome. So it really is a way just to get this out to people earlier. You know, I've heard from a lot of our listeners who have read the first two volumes that, like you said, they are also just really anxious to get their hands on the third one. So it's really exciting. You know, for those who aren't familiar with these books, however, tell everyone a little bit about what you're doing with These Are the Voyages. And of course, the first two, you were honored with a Saturn Award, which I think was really outstanding. And I think really highlights just the quality and the depth of what you're putting into these volumes.
I was blown away by that because, you know, Saturn Award is the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy and Horror Films. So they usually don't give awards out for books, but they gave me a special achievement award back in June of this year for volumes 1 and 2. You know, these books started way back in 82 when I did some initial interviews with Gene Roddenberry. And it just took me a lot of years to not only accumulate all the research that I wanted working in my part-time, but also to be able to free up the time to write these. It took about 2 years per book, so 6 years. So about 6.5 years ago, I started writing them and taking all the research and all the memos and Nielsen ratings and everything I'd collected over a couple decades and started putting them all together. And the intent of these books is to be a time machine so that when you read them, it takes you back there and you're at Desilu Studios and you're at Paramount mm-hmm. when they took over and you're watching the scripts being written for each episode. You're watching each episode being filmed, you know, where it was filmed, what went right, what went wrong, the battles that were fought, mostly between the network and the studio against Roddenberry and his people and all the struggles they went through to get this show on, where they had to invent everything and create all the special effects and things that had never been done before. And the more I found out, it was going to be one book, but the more I researched and the memos that I collected, I realized there was no way that this could all be squeezed into one book. So we decided to do one for each season. And the first book was 600 pages. The second book was about 650. This one's 750, so the story gets more dramatic, obviously, as you go along season by season, and the obstacles became greater for them in trying to get the show made.
Well, tell me going into season three. Now, season three is famous for the fact that, yes, the show came back, but the production side was perhaps more of a struggle because of constrained resources and such.
Yes.
What's the most interesting thing that you found out about season three and all of your research?
You know, a lot of stuff. I'll try to pick one or two for you real quick. Is you know, a lot of people, they say, well, season three isn't as good as the first two. It's not bad. There's a lot of great episodes in season three, like Tholian Webb and Spectre of the Gun and All Our Yesterdays. And what Roddenberry's mm-hmm. favorite episode from the entire series was The Empath, and DeForest Kelley felt the same way. So there's some fine episodes in the third year, but the problems they were dealing with is, one, the budget had been cut. Again, each year it got cut back, and Desilu went out of business. As you see in book two, Lucy lost her studio because of Star Trek and Mission Impossible. Right. They were just too expensive. Paramount came in and said, "We're not going to let this happen to our studio." So they cut the budget back considerably to where Bob Justman, the co-producer, was saying, my God, you know, at this point, we're trying to make half a science fiction movie every week on the budget of a radio show, which is what it felt like to him. Mm-hmm. And so they couldn't do as much. They would be the pacing of the episodes would be slower because there was less camera setups available. They couldn't go on location as much, things of that nature. They would get these great scripts, and they would have to take a lot of stuff out of them in order to make them affordable. And that was breaking everybody's hearts. But also, Gene Roddenberry had a big falling out with NBC, so he distanced himself from the show. Not right away. You're going to be very, very surprised, as I was, how involved he is with season three. In the beginning, he gave out the first 16 script assignments, and you'll see a lot of memos from him in the development of those scripts and so forth. But also, the FCC at that year, the Federal Communications Commission here in the U.S., was on a war against violence on TV. And Star Trek was always billed as an action-adventure series. And they were saying, we don't want any violence. And so they were taking out a lot of the action out of the action-adventure. So the feel of the show changed quite a bit for that third year. But it wasn't because Fred Freiberger, the new producer, didn't know how to produce action adventure. He was the guy who got the Wild Wild West going several years earlier. So he knew how to do macabre. He knew how to do science fiction and action and everything else. But he was just up against elements with the studio, the network, and the FCC that there wasn't a lot he could do. And I think as you read book three and you see them struggling with all these things and see all the memos as they're trying to make these episodes be as good as they can under all these horrible conditions, you realize nobody lost their talent. Everybody was still trying as good as they could to make every episode as good as it could be under the circumstances.
That's fascinating. I mean, that's something you don't even think about as the viewer watching those. I know I certainly didn't over the years watching TOS since the time I was a kid. But learning about it is just truly fascinating. So it's wonderful that Volume 3 is going to be out there. And like the picture you have on your Kickstarter right now with Volume 1 and 2 and then reserved for Season 3, you can see up there at the top, you've got T and O. So I'm ready for that S to slide right on in there.
You got to have the S for the TOS. You bet it.
That's right. That's right. So everyone can support this. The Kickstarter ends on December 1st. So just less than a week to go now, but by the time when this show drops, people will have a number of days, especially over the Thanksgiving holidays, to head over and support it and get that book in their hands for the holidays.
That's it. I think it ends on November 31st, but I could be wrong. I think it's the last day of November. So, but maybe it does go into December 1st. But either way, yeah, mm-hmm. We're winding down. I think it's 6 days left. And
You know what? So. I'm seeing, because I'm in Japan, it shows me Japan Standard Time. So for me, it's December 1st, but you're right. For everyone in the States, it's going to be November 30th.
And if you miss that, you can fly to Japan and you can get it in that last day.
That's right. might cost you a little bit extra, though.
Oh, yeah, the postage. Yeah, this is only for domestic. However, you can send an email to Alec Peters, who is managing the Kickstarter. It's on the page if you live outside of the United States. And the minute the Kickstarter ends, he'll calculate what it would cost to get you a copy mm-hmm. of the book to wherever you live. And if that's affordable to you, then you can go ahead and place an order at that time.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's great for people like me. All right. Well, Mark, thanks again for taking some time out for me tonight and telling everyone about this really great book series.
You bet, Christopher. Good talking to you always.
When The Next Generation launched, Gene Roddenberry and the writers wanted to make sure it had its own identity and wasn't perceived as a rehash of the original series. So for the second episode, of course, they pulled out a script written in 1967 as a planned sequel to The Naked Time, and they reworked it a bit to feature the crew of this new Galaxy-class starship. More fancy water molecules meant more life-threatening strange behavior, and a story that felt wildly familiar to the fans TNG was trying to win over. So today we're going to talk about this episode. And of course, you know, listeners in the network told me last week they didn't get enough of me saying naked. And therefore, we're going to do the naked now this week. And to help us do that, we're joined by someone we had to have on for this show, given what happens to Tasha and Data, Suzanne Abbott. Suzanne, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
We had to have you on because, you know, you are the queen of fanfic. And I know that this episode must have given you so many ideas over the years.
Oh, yes. All the untapped potential between Picard and Beverly. Just, I wrote so many fanfics about that alone.
That's what you did before you got Kathy and Coco, right?
Yes, before Janeway and Chakotay entered my life and have been ruling it ever since.
Well, also joining us back for, it's been a while since she's been on The Ready Room, but she's been on other shows. First time Trek from Twitter, Andy Vanderkolk. Andy, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Okay, I have a feeling this show's going to get a little bit crazy today. It's certainly looking at the outline that we have here. But of course, we always start off with a brief synopsis of the episode for those who haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while. Daniel, since you are a co-host of our TNG show, Earl Grey, why don't you give us a quick synopsis of The Naked Now?
Sure. This is the one, as you mentioned, where Data and Yar get it on. Oh, no, you wanted probably more than that.
That was a really quick synopsis.
So, you know, the Enterprise goes to a ship that has been sending out these weird messages. What's going on? Everybody on the ship ends up dying and killing themselves from having these crazy awesome parties, it seems like. And then the Enterprise gets infected. There's a danger presented that gives us a time limit, and we have to escape the situation, much like you talked about last week on The Ready Room, the original Enterprise did. In fact, we hear about the original Enterprise in this episode.
We do. And in the end, everyone is rescued, this time by the boy, Wesley Crusher.
The one who caused the problems in the first place.
I know, right? I'm at the end of the episode, and Picard's saying, you know, well, Riker tells Picard Wesley deserves a commendation. Riker says, I'm going to give a commendation to a science teacher as well. And I'm thinking, he caused the problem in the first place, and now you're going to praise him for solving it.
To be fair.
Thank you for causing this.
To be fair, he was not himself. And you have to wonder, I mean, teenage brains are even more hormone-soaked and unpredictable than adult brains. Thinking about how the adults were acting, it would probably be twice as bad on Wesley, and that's the only way I can justify the absolute craziness he gets up to in this episode.
However, I have one problem with that. he is impersonating the captain of the ship before he was ever infected.
Right.
Which I feel like would be at least frowned upon. At the very least frowned upon.
He's been collecting these clips of Picard saying things for a long time before this. So he's been planning this. And I also wondered if he's collected everyone on the crew saying things. I want to hear the tape where he has an entire tape of Data using contractions.
Yeah, but I got the impression he was collecting all that so he could be like, make Picard say like, good job, Wesley, you did a great job. As captain, I think you are a great officer on the bridge. Like, I got the impression that it was more like he wanted to use it as a way to get the acclaim from Picard
to
that
feel
Picard
was
clearly
himself.
Not giving him.
Instead of the standard, shut up, Wesley.
Yes, exactly.
Don't shut up, Wesley. That's one of his favorite ones.
Exactly.
And he has one of Beverly saying, Wesley, how are you? How was your day, Wesley? So he can play it when she's never around to parent him.
Do you have any permission slips you need me to sign?
Oh, I don't know if I agree, Andy, that this is why he's acting this way, because I overall think that Wesley was acting like Wesley throughout this episode, building a handheld tractor beam, you know, trying to show everyone that he knows how the ship works better than they do. Saving the day. This is what Wesley does.
Yeah, it's classic Wesley, just times 10, right?
So exactly. This is what being drunk feels like.
I know. Oh, yeah, I like, because this is the 80s, right? I love that you've got that, like, after-school special moment in there where Picard explains that, you know, alcohol is bad. It makes you feel crazy. And apparently the Tsiolkovsky has the good stuff.
Not only that, even at the end of the episode, it has that learn. Picard's like, if only we can avoid temptation, we're going to be a great crew. And I'm like, this is so weird. This feels so strange.
And then they cut to Tasha, and she has that look on her face like, well, I've already failed this test. Might as well just take me back to Earth now.
Her hair's all messed up.
Speaking of Wesley, though, the crazy eyes, I know that Will Wheaton is trying to act without being able to actually see what he's doing with the tractor beam. But this crazy eyes thing that he's got going several times in the episode, I want to see Wesley and Gowron have a crazy eyes contest.
Like a staring contest?
Yeah, like the two of them. Yeah, oh, that's great. Yeah, a staring contest, but they're both doing their crazy eyes at each other.
Who can out-crazy the others?
Yeah.
Gowron cannot not do his crazy eyes, so I think he would win.
Yeah.
At least Wesley can turn them on and off, you know.
Probably so. All right, well, as I said in the opening here, this is TNG coming out of the gate saying, we're not TOS, only we are, because this script was written originally to be a sequel to The Naked Time. And it never got used, of course, and so they pull it out here, and they decide to rework it a little bit. And what's interesting, too, to me is that they rework it to the point where DC Fontana actually asked for her name to be taken off of it, because they changed it so much from her vision for it that she decided, you know, I'm just not going to have my name on there.
That was probably a wise decision.
Yes, I was going to say smart move. Smart move from a smart woman.
So she still has a credit on there, but it's under the pseudonym J. Michael Bingham. So if you see that and you're wondering who the hell is that, well, that's Dorothy Fontana. But they reworked this to be the Enterprise D crew, and it feels to a lot of fans like The Naked Time light, because it's almost a replaying of the original episode, all the way down to the frozen people, right? You've got the same kind of, mm-hmm. of scene that you have there. And although in the original episode, they go down with their environmental suits.
Gangbusters, and hazmat suits that don't connect.
Yeah, hazmat suits, yeah. And here they just go over with no protection whatsoever and just walk around, you know.
I guess the justification for that is actually kind of played in the episode when Picard talks to Beverly and he's like, turn the quarantine up to maximum and then observe them and all of this stuff. So I guess like they didn't have that maybe in TOS time, that kind of
So scrubbers. Are you saying that there is a quarantine beam that they shoot at the other ship?
No, not quite, but you know what I mean. You know, he has that speech with her, he talks to her about it, and I guess maybe that's why they just weren't worried about it, which is kind of strange to think about, but you know.
Well,
that's the least of this episode's problems, I think.
TNG had no protocol for their quarantine, really. But it's not like TOS was better. They had the helmets of their suits did not connect to the body.
Right.
There was like all of this.
That doesn't need to connect. You don't need that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, germs can't get in there.
Well, Andy, look.
let's look
at The Naked Time, okay? They go down there, and if the hood connected to the rest, then they couldn't scratch their noses if they get an itch.
Well, and that's the thing. Somebody at some point figured this out, thought about it, and said, you know what? If I don't have to wear this stupid suit, I'm not going to wear it. And then it just stopped becoming standard procedure. So,
I do think the design of the original series suits was really cool looking. It was really weird and strange, but cool looking. Obviously not functional at all as an actual suit, but at least aesthetically pleasing.
Just as you're talking about that and I'm thinking about those suits, Spock's volcano suit in Into Darkness almost feels like it was based on the suits, the hazmat suits from The Naked Time.
It does look very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Except made out of like real material instead of shower curtains.
Hey, shower curtains.
I'd like to see them go down in the Naked Time hazmat suit in the volcano and it just bursts into flames.
Just sort of melts to him.
He's like, I can't breathe. There's so much smoke around me right now.
You know, what I think happened in this episode also with the ship, the Tsiolkovsky, it's the old Oberth class ship. I think what happened is that's not actually a different ship. That is the Grissom. And when everyone on the ship got intoxicated by the polywater, they all went crazy and they redecorated the ship and they changed the dedication plaque.
Well, somebody on board knew Russian then, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And got really confused about what happened to the USSR.
I know, I love that. You can see it on the plaque. It was built in the ship was built in the USSR. And then, what, 4 years after this episode aired, the USSR went away.
They could always make a comeback.
That's, you never know. Maybe
during World War III, who knows? You're right, absolutely right, yeah.
Well, you say they could always make a comeback. Suzanne, if you watch the news, I think that that's Putin's the plan right now, but that's for another show. All right. Well, what do you guys think about the second take on polywater intoxication, just as a concept for the episode, and especially coming right out of the gate for TNG? I mean, Suzanne, how does it work for you?
It should not have been the second episode. I wanted to know more about the crew, know them a little better, just so I could see the changes in their personalities. It just didn't work for me.
Right.
I agree totally. I mean, how are we supposed to know that they're acting out of character if we haven't learned what their character is yet? And I mean, obviously they kind of are. They give us some clues, you know, the sweating and just like saying weird things, but it just feels very contrived and it doesn't add anything to our understanding of these characters yet. I agree that it would have been a much better episode if they had even pushed it to mid-season first season. Yeah. But we definitely needed to know them more before this point.
Yeah, because we don't, like Geordi, we don't really even get to know Geordi in Encounter at Farpoint. And then already we've got him as being sort of the catalyst for the fact that there's something wrong with the crew. And I can understand that. I think as a viewer, we can understand that Geordi would like to be able to see like everyone else. Okay, so that's, if you're thinking about hidden feelings that you're keeping suppressed and they're coming out, I can see that. But I was watching it again before we recorded, and I was just thinking, at this point, I've only seen Geordi in one episode. How do we know he doesn't always fondle his crewmates' faces?
He could just be really touchy-feely.
He could be, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it just, what it effectively does is it breaks down the characters into very broad stereotypes of what their character was supposed to be. So
yeah.
Geordi being the blind guy rather than Geordi, you know? I just don't think that works very well.
Yeah.
And really, it rings false to me. It's like if you had the ability to run super fast, like 10 times faster than any other human, and then you were like, I really wish I could run like a normal human. Like, it's just like, why would you want that? You can see incredible, amazing things that no one else could possibly see. And he does say more isn't better. But even then, like, I don't understand that motivation. Like, I've never seen a rainbow. Well, you have seen a rainbow. You've probably seen a rainbow three times bigger than anybody could see.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like, I get for the purpose of the episode why they break it down that way, but it just, to me, it's just like, and I like that they never, ever really deal with it ever again. It's very rarely a plot point.
Over the course of TNG, Geordi, he cherishes his visor and the abilities that tool gives him. You know, he repeatedly refuses opportunities to have implants that would give him normal vision, as you know, we would think of it the way we see things. So they do. I mean, we're talking about this being an early episode where we don't even know who the characters are yet, and now we're having them act differently. I mean, the writers don't know who the characters yet are either, and they're having the characters act differently. And then as it plays out, you know, Geordi is fine with his visor. I did find it interesting that he makes these comments about seeing a sunset and seeing it like everyone else. And that does come back around all the way in Insurrection when he's on the bridge with Picard, which is a nice little, I have no idea if the writers even made that connection, like that it was a callback to this.
Yeah,
probably
I doubt
not
it.
Because there's so many years in between.
Well,
but for the viewer,
did,
it's kind of a nice little connection.
we did get a big goodbye reference in First Contact, so it's not unreasonable to think that maybe that's a little bit of a wink and a nod to that.
Yeah, could be. If so, it's a really nice and subtle one. And apparently Tasha, you know, we don't know if she maybe has been with a lot of other robots back on Earth or in other ships that she's been stationed on. We don't know yet, you know, is this unusual behavior for her or not?
Well, I just had a problem with the way they set up Tasha in this episode anyway, because first of all, we don't have a sense of her as mm-hmm. per the other characters. And it feels like they're trying to, force a personality on her that doesn't quite fit. Like this whole, she's trying on clothes and trying to be girly and all of these kinds of things. It feels really weird, but I don't know why they felt the need to do that. Is it because she doesn't look traditionally feminine? I don't understand that at all. And it rings false, and it's kind of jarring to see her, you know, just act what feels to be very falsely.
What did you think about that, Suzanne?
Yeah, it was like they were overly sexualizing her, then that didn't mm-hmm. really need to happen at all. I mean, what message are you trying to send by doing that?
Because I feel like thinking about this being in the 80s, maybe that is sort of where they were going with it. Like, they weren't comfortable yet with her being the character that she was and being the stronger female character. And so they did sort of naturally fall back on, she's a woman, so she's playing this role as her job, but underneath she must want to be girly. Like, I don't think we would see that these days for sure on television, but at the time they were writing this, it feels to me like that's probably what was going on as well.
Yeah, it just feels like she, they're like, we won't buy that there is a woman on the ship that cares about security and her job and all of these sort of traditionally masculine characteristics and not have this other side to her that we would understand more. But that's not the case. That's something, there are plenty of women who are like that.
I'm really conflicted because I'm not saying she's written well in this episode. And I think we're given two very different sides of her. I'm very confused. Like, when she's literally trying to seduce Data, why she brings up her crazy traumatic past. Like, when she's like, I had to escape the rape gangs when I was 6 years old. Like, it was really jarring, that scene, because I was like, this is being played for laughs right now. But now she's like kind of opening up in a way that is kind of crazy. So I feel like her like going into Troy's quarters is like, I'm insecure on the inside. Like, I went through crazy childhood experiences that I still have never recovered from. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm like reading too much into it and I'm like giving the writers credit where they probably were just, like you said, they were probably just like, oh, she's a woman. She must want to be womanly and, you know, feminine and all these things. But I was like, okay. I mean, I guess I see where they're going. Kind of, at least a little bit.
Is this the first reference we get to Yar's past with the whole rape gang thing?
I think it's the first time.
Does she mention rape gang specifically in Encounter at Farpoint, or she just talks about this world where I came from? Where?
Yeah, the what we get is people like these saved me, you know, from terrible situations. I think this is the first rape, the quote unquote rape gang kind of
where she very explicitly talks about that, which is such a strange concept anyway to have be in her past. I mean, it feels like they're using rape gang as a way to, as a shorthand for this was a terrible place. It's a very shallow way to get to that and not handled very well. And you're right, Daniel, that in the context of her bringing it up for the first time as she's seducing Data is really weird.
Yeah, it's creepy. It is really weird.
Yeah.
And also, I think they're using it as a way to explain why she's the strong woman who will stand up for herself and will fight, because women aren't supposed to do that at this point in time, you know, in writing. And like, that's the justification for why she's this way, which is, I agree, is strange.
But then why did they also have to show her making out with that one random crewman? I mean, did they go back and hook up and now she's going to hook up with Data? What the heck?
Hang on. No. I'm glad you brought this up because we see her go into engineering, walk up to this guy, just start making out with him. Then Picard calls Yar and he answers. That guy answers the call. And then Picard sends Data down. So by the time Data gets to Yar's quarters, she's already presumably redressed for Data.
Showered, like hopefully.
Says. Yeah. So she's very ready to go this episode.
You know, that scene where she and that guy walk up to each other and start making out down there, isn't it like a scene just right out of an 80s music video?
Yes. That is a perfect way to describe it. They might as well have had a wind machine and like some fog.
That would have been awesome.
I'm hoping he was infected by this point and not just randomly.
Maybe he was just super excited that someone that hot wanted to make out with him out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. That's my guess.
That was
my lucky day.
He was also a bit shorter than her, so maybe he was also intimidated by her. I don't know.
Well, one reason they couldn't have the wind machine is that just behind them, there was a woman wearing a scant. And so you couldn't have that blowing around everywhere. All right. So this is the beginning, just what we think about this, the setup of it. Let's move on. And I'm actually going to have Prince introduce this next section for us. So yes, everybody gets crazy in this episode, and we've already talked a little bit about Tasha here and what she did with Data. Another one here, while we're just on the topic of how they're writing the female characters, is Beverly. Now, of course, they're setting up from the beginning that there's some tension between Beverly and Picard, and they have this past history together. But Beverly really just, it's almost like, I don't know, you see Tasha getting all excited. She's got to find someone to be with. And now Beverly does as well, though at least it's specifically Picard that she's been longing for. I find it really funny that there is a piece of music for this episode that was written but not put in the episode that Ron Jones did titled Horny Doctor. Oh, God. That was for this part of the episode.
Oh, no.
I would love to hear that.
It's on the Ron Jones collection, so go listen to the first CD. It's on there.
Also on the Ron Jeremy collection, I believe.
The Ron Jeremy TNG scores are really, really exciting.
Okay.
But the cover art is very different than what we see in the Ron Jones collection.
I don't think a scant would work for Ron Jeremy, is all I'm going to say.
Goodness.
All right. Well, let's talk about Beverly
let's
here.
Let's get back to Beverly.
So what do you guys think about Beverly's portrayal? Besides the fact that before she gets intoxicated, she's down there in her little office and she's going to start trying to find a cure. And then Picard calls down and says, everything you need for a cure is right here. It's in the computer. And it's like, really? It is? Like, she gets so excited. Like, thank goodness, I don't have to do my job. They've actually got a cure already for me here. That's just always the impression I get from
wouldn't
her.
Wouldn't you be excited by that? I would.
No work today. Woo! This is how Beverly became chief medical officer. Somebody always happened to give her the solution because, as we find out later on at TNG, she's not exactly the best doctor sometimes. So you would think maybe she would know what she's doing. But sometimes
I mean,
she's
I take that not. As, okay, something crazy is going on. I have to be the one to fix it. Where do I start? How do I get, am I going to get there in time? There's all this pressure on me. I would be just as excited if Picard was like, oh, you know that horrible thing that's happening that you're expected to fix? Guess what? You don't have to because we figured it out. I would be like partying. I'd be super excited by that.
I was more confused as to why Troy was there trying to help. Oh, I mean, really.
Yeah, and she was really helpful. I mean, she sensed...
Let me look over your shoulder. Oh,
no,
yes.
No. She sensed Geordi felt confused. That is excellent information to have.
If she's sensing the emotions of others and Geordi's confused, maybe sometimes she just gets confused and she doesn't know why. Like, she doesn't know where it's coming from. And she's like, I've forgotten why I'm here. One thing I wanted to bring up about that specific scene, Chris, that you mentioned, when Picard is saying, here, we have everything you need. Here's the cure and everything. There's a moment, a lingering moment, where Data looks at Picard like, oh, really? You think you have the solution? Just wait for 10 minutes into this episode and you'll see it's not going. Right. I don't know what purpose it has in universe other than, like, it's foreboding, obviously, but I'm just like, why is he doing this?
I noticed that,
Daniel,
too.
Brent Spiner has read the entire script, but Patrick Stewart hasn't.
I did notice that. It was like this epic side eye who's just like, really? And just gives this look. No, well, I mean, this is another example, though, going back to Troy, of them not using Troy effectively in any way, especially in the beginning of the series, where you would think that empathy powers would be super helpful here. And they're just like, give her this vague line about how someone's feeling and then nothing else. It's like, thanks so much for that helpful bit of information that anybody could have figured out. Why couldn't we make this more? Why couldn't they figure out a way to use this is, I guess, my question, because it would be helpful.
Well, it's also like, if you have an empath and she can sense what everyone else is doing, what's going on, well, then your episodes have easy solutions. So they have to make her half Betazoid. And so she can just kind of sense what's going on. That way she can never actually give anyone the actual solution to anything. But then in Encounter at Farpoint, the writing and the acting for Troy sort of torpedoed plans for this character. They see it and they're like, okay, well, we can't do this. This isn't working. Now what do we do with this character? It's kind of like Travis in Enterprise, okay? He's a boomer. He was born in space. Oh, now everyone's in space. Well, I guess he's not special. What are we going to do with this character now that the one trick that we had for the character is gone? And Troy, actually, with Encounter at Farpoint, it reminds me a bit of what happens coming up with the Ferengi as well, where once again, we have an idea. The portrayal of it on screen didn't work, so now what do we do? We can't use that. And therefore, they don't know what to do with Troy. And, you know, coming up, she's going to go unused for like 4 episodes, and they actually were considering dropping the character because they don't know what to do with her. So it's very symptomatic here as well. I wish she had said, Beverly, I'm sensing frustration and concern from your computer. It doesn't have the information you need.
So she can communicate directly with computers. That would be interesting.
Well, she can sense what they're feeling, you know.
She can talk to Data. I guess that's kind of like doing that.
See, if Troy had been on the Heart of Gold instead of Trillion in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, she would just be saying useful things like, I'm sensing that Marvin is depressed.
Oh, I'm like, so depressed.
Thanks, Troy. Like, I didn't know that already.
You know, Beverly's portrayal isn't actually all that bad. I mean, yes, it is cheesy. And I mean, yes, it is a little worrisome. But she does continue to work through this. Like, she's so distracted, right? But she's sciencing that science. You know, she's doing her best. She does end up coming up with the cure, you know, and she does this all while apparently barely able to see straight. So, I mean, that's impressive, I guess.
She was drunk on some Picard.
And barely keeping her clothes on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, overheated, can't think about anything but Picard, but still solves the problem. That's what I want in my medical officer.
My favorite is just, oh my goodness. So she comes up to the bridge and she's like, we need to talk about something privately. It's personal. Never mind. It's just, it's urgent. And then, like, he comes into his ready room and she's like got her leg up and she's just like sitting all sexy.
Learning from Riker already.
Well, he does have a class that he teaches every Tuesday.
It's true. What's interesting that I didn't even think about.
It's a room full of chairs. Yes. No, it's like Odo's playground that he has in his quarters for shapeshifting. It's like all kinds of surfaces all over the place where you can prop your leg up.
We haven't discussed Riker. That Riker has no beard and it's very jarring.
It is.
I can't even look at Riker when he doesn't have a beard.
Well, you know, Bill doesn't have the beard. Weal does.
It's Bill, down with yeah. Bill.
Yeah. Oof.
I don't know, because I know I watched an entire season with Riker without a beard, but mm-hmm. now I can't go back. I can't watch anything with him without a beard. It like hurts my eyes.
He just doesn't look right.
His face
it's like
looks
you are so
wrong.
Unsexy. Go away.
What's wrong with your jawline, Riker?
That's how I felt when Insurrection came out. Like, Riker looked so strange without that beard.
Yeah, and it's and we as we know, without the beard, he's still not as smooth as an android's bottom. So
that's right. Now, I have a question for you guys while we're on the topic of Riker and we're still kind of early on with what happens in the episode. Why is Riker going around reading about people's showering habits?
Yes. Yes. Why does he remember that? And why does he think that's useful information? When he tells Data to search that, it's like, okay, I'm going to get on the internet and Google people showering with clothes right? on and find some useful information out of that. How is that helpful?
And then he tells Data that, you know, finding things about people showering with their clothes on is like trying to find a needle in a haystack. And I was just picturing Riker at his computer on Google, like, God, this site doesn't have the images I'm looking for. This site doesn't have the images I'm looking for.
And then later on, when Data is like, we need to narrow the search results somehow. And he's like, can you give me any context for what you were searching? And I was afraid Riker was going to be like, well, I was really drunk. And, you know. No, that's not what I mean.
No, but his actual answer is history. It happened in history.
Somewhere.
Sometime in history, somebody did this thing, and it was weird, and it's clearly the key to cracking this whole thing open.
He had a broad assignment at the academy where the instructor told him, I want you to go research about past starships named Enterprise, and he decided, you know, I really need to focus in on something here because this is just too broad. Why don't I find out about how the crew showered?
And if there are any pictures.
Right.
Riker's, if there are any pictures.
Damn, it's too bad they didn't have holodecks back then.
Riker's graduate thesis was on showering habits of the 23rd century or something like that.
In the days before Sonic showers.
Oh, boy. And he must have been real upset then when Geordi got to see the shower and Riker was stuck up near the bridge with Data.
Damn.
He didn't even get to see the guy in the shower.
Okay, before we move away from Beverly and Picard, Suzanne, you have to expand upon this. Take us into the world of fanfic inspiration from this episode.
There's just so much. The giggling, the unzipping, the creepy little wave. There's just so many, wave. Many moments.
And then Riker, I mean, Worf is like, Commander Riker, I'm in some serious trouble here. Please come up and save me.
Humans have gone crazy.
It's so funny. Worf cannot handle it at all. He's like, I need reinforcements up on the bridge immediately.
I don't know why he thought Riker coming onto the bridge would bring down the sexual tension.
It would amp it up like three notches.
I'm pretty sure Riker walks into the room and then everything just, you know, just skyrockets.
Riker would have walked up onto the bridge and then just put his foot up on Data's face as he fell on the ground.
And then Geordi would come in and start fondling Riker's face also.
We could have written a much better version of this episode, clearly.
Well, an interesting thing that I actually didn't really think about until this conversation we're having is the three women in the show. All their, you know, their inhibitions are all sexual related, you know, and all of the men seem to, except for Data, but he gets seduced by the woman, right? And like all of the men, like Picard, like just gets really distracted and can't focus, and Wesley gets super Wesley, but then Data just gets like slap happy. He gets silly and, you know, oh, I'm so goofy. That's an interesting thing, right? Like, I guess maybe that's just 80s writing, like we were talking about before. But, you know, all of the women are like, especially, you know, we get one scene where Troy's infected. Yeah. And she like rushes to Riker and is like, don't you want to be with me? Like, don't you want to be mine?
Yeah, it's super stereotypical, right?
Well, I want to know, where were the weepy drunks? Where were the angry drunks?
Well, no, Geordi was the weepy drunk for sure. He was almost crying when he was talking to Tasha. He's like, help me to see. You know?
I feel like if we had gotten any of Worf being infected, that would have been our angry drunk.
That would have been neat.
I can just picture Worf just like drunk, striding through each room and just throwing stuff on the floor, against the wall, punching things. That would have been that. But you're right, Daniel. All of the women, apparently their deep, dark, hidden inhibitions as to, you know, have sex with men.
Mm-hmm. Or robots. That's,
like, let's awesome. Get it on should be playing in the background in every room.
Although, right. I guess, I mean, you know, Suzanne, when you were just, like, different kinds of drunk, like, Troy is more, which makes sense for her character, actually, is what much more emotionally drunk. It's I don't know if it was sexual so much as I need the presence of this person that I care about.
Well, she and Riker have that connection,
right.
So
yeah.
For them, it's not just, like, random crew member.
Imzadi.
Yeah, right.
And apparently, Assistant Chief Engineer Jim Shimoda just reverts to childhood and starts playing Jenga.
Oh, boy.
Well,
oh,
who
boy.
Can blame there. Him, really?
Yeah, Jenga's pretty awesome.
Jenga is fun. You're at work. You know, things are getting a little weird. Mm-hmm. Why not just start playing Jenga in the middle of everything?
Yeah. Things are getting weird. He messed up so bad that not only did we never see him again, but we never see his uniform again, even. Like, they're just goodness. Like, we don't want anything to do with this guy.
I mean, this uniform they gave him, I really am wondering, especially the level of engineering knowledge and Starfleet training that he exhibits. It's almost like he was part of the janitor crew that just wandered into engineering.
And that makes total sense, because I really wanted to bring this up, because Wesley uses his Picard machine to call McDougal to the bridge, who's apparently chief engineer all of a sudden, and she goes to the bridge. Then he calls janitor guy to the sick bay, and he like looks around, and Wesley shows up, and he's like, I can't leave. I'm the only one on duty. And there's like 15 people walking behind him. I'm like, who are all of these people in engineering that can't take over for you? I don't understand what's going on right now.
Obviously, Wesley is the best choice to leave right. in charge during a crisis.
Yes,
that's what
they were all
any
just
engineering
through.
Crew member is obviously thinking.
Well, I have a theory on this whole engineering thing that I want to share with you guys. It finally occurred to me what's going on here. And it's all because when Picard calls the chief engineer to the bridge, McDougal and Shimoda, they look at each other like, is that you? Is that me? And what I've figured out is that they're actually, it's like a Schrodinger's cat scenario. See, at first, either one of them could be chief engineer or assistant chief engineer. And it's not until one of them actually accepts that I'm the chief engineer, I should go to the bridge, that they become the chief engineer, and then by default, the other person becomes the assistant chief engineer.
No, what really is happening is McDougal looks at janitor guy, and she says, you're not wearing appropriate uniform to go to the right. bridge, I don't
you
think.
You can't go to the bridge dressed like that.
I was thinking rock, paper, scissors.
Lizard Spock.
Exactly.
The look is so funny, though. I mean, they look at each other like, me, you, I'm not sure here. Which one of us is in charge?
I did it last time. You go.
They were confused because neither of them were Argyle, and they didn't know who was second
See,
to Argyle.
Now, yes. That's my other thing. Now I'm wondering if Argyle, at this point, he's always there. He was living in the Jeffries tubes. He was distilling his gin, as we always talk about here on the network. And then after Shimoda and McDougal screw up so badly in this episode, they climb in the Jeffries tubes. They pull him out. They make him chief engineer.
Was he kicking and screaming as they were pulling him out?
Yeah, and he was like putting post-it notes over the peepholes so people wouldn't find those. And yeah. Andy's going, what are you guys talking about?
I know who Argyle is. Isn't he the guy that the actor tried to start a writing campaign to become chief engineer and that really didn't work out for him?
Got himself canned.
He was really the original thinker of the Kickstarter campaign, and it just didn't work out for him. So
I was happy when he was gone. I didn't like him. I didn't like the look of him. He seems shady.
Again, as we're alluding to here, he's not gone.
Oh,
he's just gone, in the Jeffries tubes.
He's making gin, Jeffries tubes
now.
He's always there.
The name like Argyle, you'd think it'd be whiskey.
Well, it's the only thing, you know, more generic than Scotty.
Well, as we're talking about with some of the writing ideas here and how stereotypical they are, I'm surprised they didn't bring Argyle in, except he would wear a scant and like knee-high Argyle socks.
A tartan scant.
Yeah, that would be his uniform. All right, so who else has acted strangely here that we haven't really talked about yet? Well, we're going to get to Wesley Crusher. Let's save that for our acting Wesley Crusher part. While we're on the topic of engineering, though, since we're here, this episode for me, it just really highlights what a mess the concept of engineering is at the beginning of The Next Generation. And this idea that Gene Roddenberry had that this ship is so advanced that it can fly itself and we don't need a chief engineer and we don't need an engineering section. But of course, fans are expecting that there's going to be a chief engineer. It's a starship. You want to see that there's some kind of engineering section. So we do get, you know, a bit of a set here. But we've got these, you know, panel, like glass panels all around. It looks very different than the engineering that we come to know later on. But why is it so easy for a kid to take over engineering? And I also wonder how people like McDougal and Shimoda got jobs in Starfleet in the first place, because Shimoda seems incapable of doing anything except playing Space Jenga. And McDougal seems like she's really pissed that this kid has screwed up the ship, and she's just not interested in trying to fix things, and she's just not going to do it. And that's not the attitude that you expect from a Starfleet officer.
Wesley has a magical repulsor device that stops them from entering the physical space, right? Now, we're watching Star Trek. If only we had some sort of device which allowed us to get places that we couldn't normally access. Unfortunately, we're just screwed. I guess we'll all die because there's no possible way to get there other than going through the force field.
Well, at this point, we're still in that phase of we don't beam around the ship, right? Within Star Trek. Unless we really have to, I guess.
We haven't established site to site. But even then... there, like you mentioned before, Chris, there are glass panels between them and where Wesley is. And if your ship's about to explode, you could probably break through the glass, I think.
I think that we should make a pitch for Daniel to take over as chief engineer. Because clearly he would have done a better job.
But is it really glass or transparent aluminum?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, I would think that at this point in time, they've probably got some kind of laser knife that can cut through transparent aluminum.
One thing we didn't talk about that I have a big problem with, and TNG does this occasionally, and I say occasionally, very, very loosely, is Data gets affected by something that should not affect Data at all.
Right. No, it shouldn't.
No reason.
But not if only you that, prick Daniel, him, does he not leak?
Yes. And not only that, Daniel, but at the end, Picard uses the hypospray on him.
Oh. But he's fully functional.
Oh, it irritates me. It irritates me to no end with what they do here. Like, because Data, whatever.
It's great because this is clearly the writers being like, well, this makes no sense, but let's cover that up with some Shakespeare. Or whatever that is. That's Shakespeare,
but does
right?
that just go back to his hookup with Tasha?
I don't know. I really don't know how to make this work.
Well, and one thing, so I decided halfway through the episode, it's way too inconsistent with the, like, if you get infected, how long does it take to affect you? And I decided, because it's way too inconsistent, so I decided there's no rules. Yeah. So at best, at the very best, Data takes advantage of a crazy drunk woman in this episode.
It's true.
And like, and why would he do, like, Data, why, like, okay, Data, you can have sex. That's great. And that's actually a really interesting thing to know. That's probably a pretty interesting conversation we can have later on down the line. But you know this woman is inhibited. Like, why are you not, like, red flags raising in your software? Like, whoa, lady. No, I'm just here to take you to sick bay. I'm not looking for anything, you know?
But if you're offering, hey.
Yeah, no,
that was the look on his face. It was, what?
I don't understand how Data is able to be seduced.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Same here.
He's never seen underboob before.
I guess.
And so that's what it is.
But seriously, like,
it's because
show
that's more elusive
Daniel?
Than side boob. Yeah.
This version of Data just doesn't track for me based on how he is at all other times during the show. I mean, he's very clearly emotionless and logical and all of these other things. And then all of a sudden, Tasha Yar is like, hey, you're fully functional. And he just goes completely out of character. It really is a stretch for me, writing-wise and science-wise. And the fact that that is her pickup line, everything does not work. Fully functional might be the most awkward pickup line I've ever heard.
and the fact that, like you mentioned, that they play it off for laughs, that he's like, oh, my chemical whatever is just like your blood. We're like exactly the same all of a sudden. Like, okay, whatever.
And then how does Data get affected but Worf doesn't?
Right.
Nobody touches Worf because they're kind of racist right. still, I think,
Worf's
towards Klingon.
Hands off.
He's got cooties.
That's the other thing, is they never explain how it spreads.
You have to
touch
the sweat.
Well, you have to be
sweat.
Touched, yeah, because yeah. There's a whole thing where, like, actually, is it Beverly, I think, that says, like, you touch so-and-so, and no,
yeah,
no
Riker
you
touched
me,
her.
And oh,
yeah.
And I can't get this, so. You,
okay.
Yeah.
And this is why I gave up on the rules halfway through the episode, because Beverly specifically states that Riker should have been affected, and then he infected her, but then he doesn't get infected until later on in the episode. He never, or doesn't show symptoms anyways, until much, much later on in the episode when Deanna touches him. That's when, like, they make the special sound effect, like he was infected. And I'm like, wait a minute, how could he have transmitted it to Beverly if he didn't have it in the first place?
No, didn't he pick up Deanna and take her to sick bay?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm thinking of another instance, because there was a time that he should have been infected that he wasn't.
Well,
he transmitted it to Beverly, and then later on somebody else touches him. I might have gotten that mixed up in my head.
And it seems that McDougal never gets infected, does she? Or is she the stubborn drunk? Is that why she doesn't want to fix anything?
She just gets focused on one thing, and nobody can convince her to do anything but that one thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that.
Except she just can't do it.
She incompetently focuses on one thing.
Maybe in like 4 or 5 hours, but no.
Yeah. After a cup of coffee or something, I mean, cold shower or a frozen cold shower
with her clothes on.
If we're talking about it as being drunk, then, you know, the idea that it affects people differently makes perfect sense, right? Because, you know, one person can drink 5 beers and you can't even tell they're drunk, and one other person can drink 1 beer and they're already acting crazy.
By the way, that's me.
I would be the 5 beers.
So that makes sense to me that it could be, you know, it affects people differently that way. But
and of all the people, you would think Riker would probably be the most used to being drunk and, you know, whatever, debauchery of all sorts, I would imagine. So
would be Riker.
Yeah, would be Riker. He would be totally okay. You know, he'd be totally cool under all those circumstances.
Right.
He probably could still
maybe play
his
trombone.
That's why
it didn't affect him for that long.
But the way that Data gets affected by this, it doesn't make any sense.
None at all.
So, well, let's go on. We have a couple more items here before we wrap up. One is acting Captain Wesley Crusher, which we've talked about a little bit already, but this is just like in the Naked Time where acting Captain Riley takes over engineering. Now we have Wesley taking over engineering. And, he's also got his little tractor beam that we talked about here as well, which is a very Wesley thing to do, to create a tractor beam. And I think I said this last week, combine these two episodes, you could have Wesley in the Naked Time using his tractor beam to lift the chair that Riley's in to get him out of engineering. That would be awesome. But any more thoughts on Wesley being in here, especially, you know, we know that in TNG, Wesley is Gene Roddenberry. You know, this character, This is Gene Roddenberry's character. And the way that they praise him at the end of the episode, and of course, Worf is shocked, you know, the boy. And Beverly says, that's right, the boy. It's like the whole story is designed to praise Wesley the boy for bailing everyone out, for bailing all the adults out.
The bringer of problems and the solver of solutions, right?
The solver of solutions.
Yeah. It's obnoxious. And we really, really, I mean, the earlier in TNG you get, the more obnoxious this is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, as Gene's influence maybe waned towards the middle of the series, we get less and less of this. We always get the Wesley's special thing. We always get that. But it's not like this episode, which is infuriating.
It's one thing to be special. I mean, we all think our children are special, right? But there's a difference in a child being special and just being obnoxious, as Wesley is in early episodes.
Well,
when
in this episode, he gets to apparently map out changing all of the circuits out to change it to propulsion, something that McDougal says is like going to take weeks. And he's like, oh, no, I can do it. Touch, 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 done. Like that Ta-da. Kind of stuff is just, it doesn't make sense.
Well, this does support my theory that McDougal has no engineering training.
Can't be done. Wesley's like, sure, again. Boop, boop, boop. Can't you do it in your head like I can?
Oh, right. Yeah. Just do it in your head. Just think about it. It's easy.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the more extreme examples of it. And what irritates me, like, fine, at the end when he's like, Riker's like, you should mention him in your log. Absolutely, sure. Absolutely. If you mention that Wesley's in the brig, because that's where he deserves to be in this episode, you know, like he totally blocked off main engineering, allowed all the chips to be pulled out, didn't do a thing. He hijacked essentially the ship. Fine, give him a commendation for saving it, but he should be in jail for what he did in this episode.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, Picard's not going to put Bev's son in jail.
Especially after she unzipped her top there a little bit.
All right. Well, so last thing to touch on here, Daniel, I know you've seen the Blu-rays, and Suzanne, Andy, you guys said you have not seen the Blu-rays, right?
No.
There are a few things that look incredibly better on the Blu-rays, and there's one huge oversight that thankfully was fixed early in the episode when they're looking at the records from the original Enterprise. In the original version in this episode, they show the movie Refit Enterprise.
I thought so. Screen. I was like, that doesn't look right.
So thankfully on the Blu-ray, they replaced it with the actual Constitution Class Enterprise from the original series.
I imagine at the time, it's because they were, what, at this point, probably just working on Star Trek V at this time, right around this time. So they probably had the computer model already built. Mm-hmm. So they were just like, yeah, just throw it in there.
Fans will never notice.
They'll never notice.
But no, fans go, wait a minute, that's not Kirk's Enterprise from the Naked Time. It's like the first thing you see, right?
And, you know, honestly, as a TNG fan, I just have to say, the TOS people will also agree to this. Like the Blu-rays, I want all of Star Trek to be on Blu-rays. Oh my goodness, it's so beautiful. Just to even these early episodes where like you said, it's night and day. They're totally different episodes once you get to see them in high definition, and to go back and to hear the amazing mixing and these awesome visuals that they redo. I really have all of my fingers and toes and everything crossed for Deep Space Nine and Voyager on Blu-ray, because I think all Star Trek fans deserve to see what they want, what they love the most on Blu-ray. You know,
I have to have Voyager. I have to have it. Give it to me now.
Another thing on the Blu-rays is the stellar fragment coming towards the Tsiolkovsky and the Enterprise. That is just, on the original, it's just this sort of washed out white blob coming towards them, right? And even the explosion is completely washed out. But it's so rich and vibrant. You can see so much texture in this glowing orange, yellowish stellar fragment coming towards. It actually feels like there's some threatening object coming towards the ship on the Blu-ray. And, you know, I think those little things do make the story feel better and more vibrant, just as a story goes even.
On the other hand, in the Blu-rays, you can tell that Wesley's tractor beam thing is just a motherboard taped to some cardboard.
Also, on Beverly's desk, when she realizes that she's going to actually have to come up with a solution on her own, and she reaches over to all her little plastic pads that she has on the side, those you can tell are like plastic pieces of plastic with decals stuck on them on the Blu-ray.
So it's not all good, but, you know,
overall,
it
doesn't necessarily hold up as well. But but when you can truly gaze into Wesley's crazy eyes as if he's right there in front of you in real life, I mean, that makes it all worth it. All right. Any final thoughts on the episode and also our ratings here? Suzanne, how about you?
Final thoughts. It was an all right episode. It aired so early on in the series, not knowing these characters, not knowing their personalities. It's not really something, an episode that I enjoy other than the little Picard crusher moments. Had it been maybe third season, fifth season, it would have been awesome. It really would have. But so early in the series, it just wasn't for me. And my rating is going to be 2 unzipped tops.
Ooh. This actually sounds like a pretty good rating there, Suzanne.
I wouldn't complain.
Depending on whose tops they are.
All right. How about you, Andy?
I have to agree. I think the only reason to enjoy this episode is to do what we did, which is basically laugh at how ridiculous it is. And at least that much of it is fun, but goodness gracious, it's mostly a mess, and it doesn't take us anywhere that is interesting or good for the characters. So I was really not a fan of it. I'm more of a fan of it now that we did this. Now it makes me think of it in a better light. But overall, a very weak episode. I'll give it 3 isolinear chips.
Excellent. How about you, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with both of you ladies. It's not a good episode. I have a bit of a soft spot for these really early TNG episodes. They're like, one thing we didn't bring up is the music in this episode.
I think we talked a lot about the music, Daniel.
Well, okay.
Both versions of it, in fact.
Specifically when we didn't talk about what it added or subtracted from the episode. And it's very TOS-y, this music. Mm-hmm. I mean, the episode, of course, as you mentioned, is a TOS-y kind of episode. And there's a lot of that element in it. And it's interesting, especially in the earlier seasons, to think of TNG as phase two, to see like how they were building to what TNG became, because this is very different than the TNG most people think of when you say Star Trek The Next Generation. And it's growing pains, and I can appreciate it for that. Not a good episode, however, and there's a lot of problems with it. Some fun to be had, but take it or leave it, I guess. I'm gonna give it 3 naked frozen people.
Well, I'm with you guys on this episode. It's I guess like you, Daniel, have a soft spot for it just because I remember watching TNG when it came on, and it, you know, for so many years we just had TOS and then we just had TNG, and I have memories of that time. But it's not a great episode, and it makes no sense to have the characters acting this way. Second episode in the series. The Blu-ray helps some for me because there's a lot of really nice visuals to look at in the Blu-ray. You can see a lot of details on screens and props that you couldn't see before. So I like that. But yeah, it's just fun to have this type of conversation and joke about. So I'm going to give this episode 2 uncomfortable throat clears.
Beverly, not now.
All right. Well, Suzanne and Andy, thanks for joining us today. Before we go, Suzanne, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs.
You can find me on the Twitter at Suzanne Abbott, or you can find me trolling around Facebook on the Trek FM webpage.
Fantastic. All right. Andy, how about you?
I'm also on Twitter as at First Time Trek, where I'm live tweeting my first watch of Star Trek. I'm on the original series now. And I also have First Time Trek on Tumblr, where I'm archiving all of my old tweets. So if you missed them the first time around, they're going to slowly be going up on Tumblr as well.
Sounds good. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It was fun.
All right, Chris. Well, it was great talking to Suzanne and Andy about the naked now, as opposed to the naked time. Are you ready to be naked now, or is there a time where you're going to be ready to be naked?
Well, I thought, as we discussed in news, that it's just all naked all the time, right?
I mean, Riker would approve of that. I think, yeah, for sure.
He really would. I really want to see that training area that we talked about where Riker. Where you practice propping your leg up on stuff.
Nakedly.
All right. Yeah, it was really, really fun today. And it maybe gave me some new fun things to think about when I watch this episode next time, if I watch it again. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
But instead of it being a human being prejudiced against Vulcans because the Romulans look like Vulcans, the Vulcans are taking advantage of themselves looking like Romulans in order to be racist against Romulans.
Earl Grey.
So he's got the two armrests, and the right one says little, you know, Ensign, you know, Lamont, and the little arrow. And then the one on the left says Lieutenant Commander Data. Like a little arrow. Yeah.
The orb.
But when they pull away from that window with Jake and Kira, and they pull away from the station, it's like they're closing the book. They're actually closing the back cover of the book, and it's the end of the story.
To the journey!
How do you feel, Char, about the Borg Queen?
Oh boy. I think the longer that I have watched Star Trek, the more I'm in the camp of, I don't know if I like her.
The Ready Room.
They want you to come across on Archer's side where he can be mad at Trip. But I have a really hard time being Archer being mad at Trip because just think of if we still treated, you know, people of a different race like this.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
That can honestly be the reason they brought Wesley, because Wesley's got nothing else going for him there. I mean, yes, he can lead those kids, but that's just going to be by virtue of his age. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, he's 15 years old. Of course, all the other kids are going to look up to him, at least for a while. Then if he ends up being a total tool, then they won't.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Yeah, Learning Curve was never meant to be a season one finale. They were going to do the 37s, and then UPN wanted to open season two with it, and that totally didn't work either.
Man, you gotta say UPN really ooped it up.
Literary Treks.
What Jerry Taylor talks about with Catherine Janeway's life is... it's kind of a series of her relationships. I mean, she should be doing all sorts of fantastic things, right? And instead, we're learning about her boyfriends.
Melodic Treks.
But there's a whole host of people that appear in Star Trek. As I said, most of it is classical, so it's Verdi, Vivaldi, Strauss, Troisky, Harry Kim.
The 602 Club.
This really does have an impact on, I think, the entire, you know, comic book world. Dark Knight Returns still have a huge impact in the way that people view Batman today.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, you'll find us in iTunes or in the podcasts app on your iOS device. go ahead and hit subscribe on that. That way you'll get the episode as soon as I publish it. And that also helps us rise up in the search results in the iTunes store so other Star Trek fans can find The Ready Room. And while you're there, please leave us a star rating and a written review if you have a moment. We love to hear what you think about the show. And that also helps other fans find us because that influences how we place in search results as well. If you're not an Apple user, you can find us in many other places. We're on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. We're on SoundCloud. You can also stream from the website. You can download an MP3 file from our website, and you can even grab the RSS link for The Ready Room and pop that into any third-party application that you like. Another way that you can help us out here on the network is to become a patron through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll see our current goals and our perks for different milestone contribution levels. We have many people helping us out over there right now. Your support there is critical to making it possible for us to keep the network going. So we hope that you'll check us out there. And another thing that we just opened up here this week, it's sort of a soft launch for our new shop. We've had many listeners ask us when they would be able to buy coffee mugs or t-shirts with our cover art and other things on them. And we've started doing that now. And that's another way that you can help us out and support the network. If you want to check that out, go to trekfm.spreadshirt.com. trekfm.spreadshirt.com. And you'll see our store there. We'll put an item up on the menu bar on our website as well. And we've got quite a few items there right now, but we'll have more coming up soon as well. And check those out. Get some great artwork, alien illustrations by Tobu Ushi, cover art on mugs, and so forth. And we hope you'll support us through our shop there on Spreadshirt. I'd also like to thank real quick our associate producer of the show, Renee Roberts, who helps us bring The Ready Room to you every week. You can find Renee on Twitter at @Mares_1701. Go follow Renee and tell her thank you for all she does for the network here. We really appreciate her support for many years now here at Trek FM. Now, Daniel, we've told everyone where to find us a couple times during the show today, but we haven't told people where to find you. So when you're not, you know, trying to figure out how to get Tasha Yar to seduce you, where can people find you?
Well, they can find me where I can get Ro and some Ro to seduce me.
Oh, yeah. No, that's who you really want, right?
Yeah, of course. Or, you know, Chris as a Niner, Jadzia. If Jadzia can seduce me, I'm totally okay. No. Of course, they can find me on Twitter at @1UpDan. That's the number one, not the word. And I'm also on Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated TNG show. We're on there every week. Me and my co-hosts, Philip and Darren, we talk a lot about the same kind of thing. Like, we talked about TNG Season 1. We have a whole episode dedicated to TNG Season 1. Go check us out there, and we have a good time every week. So please have a listen.
Yeah, Earl Grey is a lot of fun. And also, while we're talking about TNG, we should also plug our friends John and Ken on Mission Log, also here on the network. They're currently in TNG. Great thing about their show is they're eventually going to go through DS9 and Voyager and Enterprise as well. So I love hearing their take as well. So if you're a TNG fan, Trek FM is the place for you. Every fifth show here on The Ready Room, every Tuesday on Earl Grey with Daniel, Darren, and Philip. And then every Thursday with John and Ken on Mission Log.
And we hope to have them on soon. You know, we're going to do a little bit of a crossover.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be awesome.
That should be a good time. So why not? You know, take advantage of it while you can.
The Earl Grey Log. The Earl Grey Mission.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, and I'm in the Babel Conference all the time. So come over there, join the group, and we'll talk about Star Trek there. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me on lots of different shows, Literary Treks, The Orb, Warp 5, Continuing Mission, Matterstream, Hyperchannel, and the official Axanar podcast, which I co-host with Alec Peters. So catch those if you want to hear more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. And just a reminder, as we told you during news today, the different ways you can get in touch with us here on the show and share your thoughts are the Babel Conference on Facebook, as well as email by going to trek.fm/contact. Twitter, our username is TrekFM, and you can send us a voicemail if you go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM, and I'd love to hear from you through any of those channels. Before we let you go, I'd like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. That's yet another way that you can support us here at Trek FM and get a free audiobook of your choice in the process. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose any book you want absolutely free. If you decide not to stick with Audible, you'll get to keep that book, so there's nothing to lose. But when you try Audible, that helps us out. We get a little bit from them that helps cover the cost of hosting and distribution and production and everything else that we have to do here to bring you Star Trek Talk every day of the week. And if you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. So go check it out if you're not already a customer. It's one of my favorite services ever. And another place you should check out is enterpriseinspace.org. This is a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that Larry Nemechek and I are both involved in right now. And the project is building an 8-foot orbiter called the NSS Enterprise. It'll be the first Enterprise to actually go into orbit around the Earth. And it will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments, as well as test out other space technologies. And you can become a virtual crew member by visiting enterpriseinspace.org and contributing to the project. And one more thing you can do here, we've got another week or so to go on our design contest. The deadline is December 8th, but if you have an idea for what the NSS Enterprise should look like, you can submit your designs. You don't need to be an engineer. We have people who have worked with NASA, have worked on the shuttle program, who are going to be designing the ship from an engineering standpoint, but we want your ideas for the aesthetics of the NSS Enterprise. So visit enterpriseinspace.org today, submit your ideas. Someone's going to win this contest, and their design is actually going to go into space, be returned to Earth, and will go into a museum afterwards. All right, Daniel, well, that's our show for today. I'm going to let you go now and head down to sick bay. You see this bucket of cold water I've got right here? I've got to go dump that on Beverly's head.
All right, Chris, well, it's time to stick some data in it because the ready room is done.